Tragedy in Kunduz. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Doctors Without Borders wants the U.S. airstrikes that destroyed its hospital in Kunduz investigated as a war crime.
What surprises me about what Doctors Without Borders is saying is they're making conclusions before the facts have even been gathered.
And later, in Beirut, English, French, and Arabic, all in the same sentence.
You're not changing context, you're not changing place, you're not changing, you're still in the same place with the same people, and you are speaking three languages.
Plus, Chinese scientist Tu Youyou calls herself the professor of the three no's.
No postgrad degree, no experience working abroad, no membership in the Chinese Academy of Sciences.
But now she's a Nobel laureate. Those stories today on The World.
The World is brought to you by Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. You've probably heard that 22 people died when U.S. airstrikes pummeled a hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, over the weekend. The U.S. military says it's still investigating how that happened. The hospital was run by MSF, or Médecins Sans Frontières, the aid group also known as Doctors Without Borders. MSF says it's disgusted by statements from Afghan government officials saying Taliban fighters were in the hospital at the time of the bombing. My BBC colleague Shaima Khalil is following the story from Kabul. She says MSF has repeatedly denied a Taliban presence at its hospital.
Early on their Twitter feed, if you looked at it, Médecins Sans Frontières said that at no point did any of their members or staff members make a call or report any fighting that was happening in the hospital. And another thing that they said in a statement was that the doors to the hospital, the gates were closed on that day, and no one other than doctors, staff, patients and caretakers were allowed in. So that strongly suggests that they're convinced that there are no fighters or there were no Taliban fighters at the hospital at the time. And I guess this is really the contentious point in all of this, Marco, is intent. Whether or not the U.S. was quite aware of who they were hitting and where they were hitting. If they did know that they were fighters, if there indeed were fighters, then this was a targeted attack that went on for half an hour.
So I gather some of the survivors of this bombing were taken to Mazar-i Sharif, which is about 100 miles to the west of Kunduz. Have you been in touch with the people there?
Yes, they've spoken to some of our colleagues. I mean, what we know now is that the hospital in Kunduz has been completely evacuated. So the staff and the patients have been sent to different hospitals and clinics across the country. Some are here in Kabul, and some indeed, as you say, are in Mazar-i Sharif. And a couple of them spoke to our colleagues there, and they really just describe horrifying stories. And you kind of just get a little bit of that. The extent of damage, the detail of the terror they must have lived through during the bombing. You know, one of them, for example, was saying that he was just surrounded by flames, and he said that he could see people burning to death.
Shaima, I'm just wondering, were there any stories from people who had survived the attack in Kunduz, who had been taken to Mazar-i Sharif, just talking about what life is like right now in Kunduz under the Taliban?
Well, you know, here in Kabul, actually, I met a family that had just fled Kunduz a day ago, a mother of seven. Her name was Masuda, and she said that she went through a horrifying journey, many, many hours on foot, just to be able to escape the city. And that's the other thing we're hearing. Leaving the city, fleeing the city is becoming very difficult because of the constant fighting. But, you know, she painted a picture of horror in Kunduz for days. She said she was stuck in the basement of her house with her seven children. They ran out of food very quickly. They were out of food for days. But also that when the Taliban fighters took over her neighborhood, I mean, wild was the word that she used. She said they were just wreaking havoc. They were speaking on, you know, loudspeakers saying that women weren't allowed to leave the house. And if women did try to leave the house, they would shoot at them. So she described absolute fear, and she said that the fighting between the Taliban insurgents and the government forces was over their heads. And then finally, just to add insult to, you know, unbelievable injury in her case, is that her house itself was bombed at which point, of course, she said she had to leave because there was nowhere else to go. But really what she described when she left the city was very chilling, because she said as they made their way out of the city, she said, I almost stepped on the dead bodies. There were just dead bodies everywhere.
And quickly, Shaima, MSF have ceased operations in Kunduz. What options do civilians there have now for treatment if they get hurt?
That is a real tragedy, because MSF, that clinic, that hospital, was the lifeline for thousands of people, not just in Kunduz, Marco, but in northern Afghanistan, in that area. This was the probably the only place that was equipped enough, that had enough staff to treat people. And with the fighting going on, more casualties are likely to come in. And where they go from Kunduz, no one knows at this point.
The BBC's Shaima Khalil in Kabul. MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, is calling for an independent investigation into this attack on its hospital, citing, quote, the clear presumption that a war crime has been committed, end quote. It's also described the incident as a grave violation of international humanitarian law. And the United Nations human rights chief has also called the attack tragic, inexcusable, and possibly even criminal. Charlie Dunlap is a former deputy judge advocate general for the U.S. Air Force. He's now a professor at Duke University Law School. Was a strike, in your opinion, Charlie Dunlap, a war crime, the strike on the hospital in Kunduz?
Marco, I don't think we know yet. I think what surprises me about what Doctors Without Borders is saying, an organization I previously had a lot of respect for, is they're making conclusions before the facts have even been gathered. In war zones, there's a lot of complexity about the application of force and what's going on in the ground. We all heard about the chaos and fog and friction of war. And that's what is going on in a place like Afghanistan. And I think we need to assemble the facts before we start making very, very serious accusations against people.
I mean, MSF's conclusion is based on their eyewitness accounts of not seeing any Taliban fighters in their hospital. Are you saying that there are circumstances when it is okay to bomb a hospital?
Well, if a hospital is being used for military purposes, it can become a target. You still have to do a proportionality analysis. In other words, you have to make a determination that the anticipated military advantage you're going to gain will not cost excessive civilian casualties.
So in this case, with the hospital in Kunduz, what are the key questions that need to be investigated?
I think that one of the things that we need to look at is, of course, was it being used in any way by the Taliban as a military position to shoot or launch attacks against Afghan and other allied forces? And then I think we also have to explore, was a mistake made? In other words, it's not a war crime if people are acting reasonably and doing the best they can in what we would all agree would be a very chaotic and difficult situation, and something you don't want to happen happens.
The fact that the hospital was hit repeatedly for more than an hour, does that kind of indicate there's little doubt that it was deliberately targeted?
Well, I don't know. That would seem to indicate that they were deliberately targeting that building, but I don't know if they're deliberately targeting it because it was a hospital.
I mean, if it's a tragic mistake, that too would be really bad. And we saw a strike on a Taliban compound earlier this year. Later learned that two humanitarian workers were inside that compound. I mean, there are just a lot of risks, aren't there?
Well, there are. And I think anytime you use force, you have to accept that things are going to turn out not the way you intend it. Regarding the earlier drone strike that you referenced, I sometimes wonder, because there were senior Taliban leaders there, whether they thought that by keeping those hostages with them, that they were creating some kind of sanctuary for themselves. This is why international law doesn't prohibit conducting an attack, even when you know for an actual fact that civilian casualties will occur. What international law only prohibits is that they not be excessive in relation to the military advantage anticipated. And that's to preclude incentivizing parties to actually use civilians as human shields. Unfortunately, though, we've seen adversaries who nevertheless do it. And I think that that is one of the real complications of 21st century warfare.
Charlie Dunlap, former Deputy Judge Advocate General for the U.S. Air Force, now at Duke Law School. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The Pentagon now says the airstrikes on the MSF hospital in Kunduz took place at the request of Afghan forces on the ground. Most U.S. combat troops have left Afghanistan, but Americans continue to work closely with Afghan forces, especially when it comes to training. Still, there can be confusion and a lack of coordination, and it's not just Afghanistan. In Syria and Iraq, the U.S. strategy has also been to train local forces on the ground. But so far, the billions of dollars poured into these efforts are not quite paying off. The local forces are often not up to par with the battles they're supposed to fight. I spoke about this with Philip Carter. Back in 2005, he was involved in training Iraqi forces. He says what looks great on paper can often look very different in reality.
Typically, these programs work best when they are paired with a established government that just needs a little bit more support or a little bit of extra financing for their programs. Some of the best programs aren't military at all. They're programs like the Merida Initiative in Mexico or Plan Colombia that really focus on law enforcement instead of military capabilities.
Right. So you were in the Army yourself, as I said. You've got a good perspective from the ground. Why, in the case of Syria, is it not working?
It's hard to create a military or police force in even the best circumstances, let alone in combat with a determined adversary in a foreign country and so on. Second, it's not clear that the U.S.'s interests here align all that well with the rebels we're trying to train. Third, it's not clear that short-term training and assistance is sufficient to create the kind of military that can go toe-to-toe with ISIS or al-Qaeda.
What about variables, Philip Carter, on the ground that we don't hear much about, like language skills or person-to-person contact between trainers and the people they're training? I mean, how does that change the efficiency on the ground?
These missions are notoriously hard. Without excellent language ability and a human ability to connect and a sense of shared sacrifice, it's very difficult to partner with and train and advise foreign militaries. There are parts of the U.S. special operations community that excel at it, but even within the Army's famed Green Berets, Arabic language ability and the ability to operate in these situations is still difficult, and it can be hamstrung by policy decisions. In this case, the decision merely to train and equip these forces as opposed to deploy embedded advisors with them meant they didn't have the full benefit of U.S. forces alongside them, helping them out on a day-to-day basis. It's not clear that would have made the difference, but it has in other situations.
And Philip Carter, what was your own experience training either National Army or opposition forces?
I fought in Iraq in 2005 and 6. I was an embedded advisor with the Iraqi police in Iraq's Diyala province, which is a ethnically mixed province to the north and east of Baghdad. And we had a great deal of difficulty creating both the expertise and the will among police officers to face down al-Qaeda in a very violent time. We also had a great deal of cultural translation problems. We knew how to create an American police force or a Western police force. We knew a lot less about how to take existing police and resources and really create what the Iraqis wanted and needed. And so where we succeeded, it was generally just with a light touch or a little bit of extra resources to support an initiative that they themselves came up with.
The opposite of any approach would be no approach, just leaving the situation alone. Is that an option?
I don't think it is, because I think the U.S. has a broader interest in regional stability, and this matters so much to our local partners and allies such as Israel and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and others. There's also a broader moral issue here, particularly relating to Syrian refugees, that we cannot turn our back on. That said, there is probably a way to satisfy those interests without deploying U.S. troops or continuing to send mission after mission of special operations forces to train and equip Syrians in ways that don't work.
Former Army officer Philip Carter, now with the Center for a New American Security. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Remembering the man who gave us Wallander and Volander, that's coming up here on The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like marketing, meditation, and metalworking. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Marco Werman here with The World. We're going to check in now on a group of young men whose lives took a dramatic turn 5 years ago. They were just boys when they survived the massive earthquake in Haiti back in 2010. Later, they came here to Boston, where there is a large Haitian community. Even so, it was a hard transition for them. But there's a youth center in Dorchester here in Boston that's making a big difference in their lives even now. My WGBH colleague Rupa Shenoy has that story.
17-year-old Ricardo Sherry won't talk about what happened when the earthquake hit. All he'll say is that the uncle he was living with was killed.
Every time I try to think about it, it's just bringing me some like bad dreams.
It brings him bad dreams to think about it, he says. But even when he doesn't think about the earthquake, it affects him. When he got to the U.S., Sherry lived in a two-bedroom apartment in Boston with his mother, two brothers, and a sister. He played video games compulsively. He failed courses or got D's at the local high school. His mother was working long hours at a janitorial job, and he felt guilty.
It was just me that was like holding myself back.
Sherry wasn't the only teenage earthquake survivor at his school who had problems adjusting. Dorchester has one of the biggest concentrations of Haitian Americans in the country, which is why a lot of Haiti earthquake survivors ended up here. A Haitian American school counselor recognized a pattern among the boys. She sent them to a Haitian American staffer at a YMCA down the street. That was Reggie Jean, whose family had also taken in relatives, including his 4-year-old cousin, who was pretty open about what went on during the Haiti earthquake.
And this little girl's like, yeah, it was crazy. People were crying, and I couldn't find my mom for a long time. And it's like, wow, wow, wow.
But Jean says teenaged boys generally won't talk, and that's led to lots of problems. So he looked for a uniquely Haitian solution. Jean convinced his Y to turn an old donated row house into, essentially, a clubhouse for the Haitian boys who needed help. The place is packed with boys and has an almost frat-like atmosphere. If there were Haitian fraternities, they'd probably sound like this. A game of dominoes, Haitian style, is a lot like cards, except noisier. It's all about math and bluffing. 16-year-old Jeffrey Moreau dominates these games. Three boys sitting across from him choose dominoes and line them up in their cupped palms. Other boys crowd around and lean over the table to watch. One player quietly tries to slide a domino back on the table. Moreau calls him out.
Nah, you gotta keep it.
I didn't look at it.
I didn't see it, bro.
Moreau came here before the earthquake, 6 years ago, and has the wisdom and bearing of an old-timer. He says many of the boys who came more recently look up to him.
They seen a lot of stuff in Haiti. A lot of stuff go down. So, like, in Haiti, like, some people just, like, don't have no hope. Just, like, oh well, there's nothing to do there. And then when they come here, it's, like, they become discouraged. They don't know what to do because there's too much to do.
Moreau says this place may not seem like much, but the environment is comforting. It reminds the boys of the domino games on the streets of Port-au-Prince, where players released pieces so fast and hard that they sometimes break. Moreau remembers people crowded around, watching games, swearing, yelling, and betting. He says recreating that environment has helped the boys build a new community.
Not having that, like, it affects you. Like, coming here, like, you already have your group. Everybody is nice. Everybody knows you and understands you and understand what you've been going through.
Over dominoes, the boys talk casually now and then about their memories of Haiti. Jean says he doesn't push them.
Just like, you know, we'll laugh about it. Oh, when I was in Haiti this time. But, you know, I allow them to give me as much information as they want to as we build that relationship.
Help like that got Ricardo Sherry's grades up. He gets mostly B's now.
Your mind is, like, calm, and you're not worrying about, like, homework and stuff like that. And it also reminded me when I was in Haiti.
Sherry says remembering how he used to play dominoes with his friends back home settles his mind. The games help him concentrate in general. Sherry's relieved that now he can focus on school. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
PBS viewers know all about Kurt Wallander, the soul-searching Swedish police detective. Well, the man who created Wallander has died. Swedish crime novelist Henning Mankell died today of cancer. He was 67. Writer and journalist Barry Forshaw says Mankell is a Nordic noir legend.
Without any exaggeration, you could say he was the master. He wasn't the first, but he created the breakthrough detective Wallander. and pretty well everything followed from that.
Yeah, you say Wallander. Okay. What would you say then, as far as the writing goes? What was the soul of Henning Mankell's writing? What distinguished his crime writing from the whole very popular Scandinavian crime genre now?
He really was the Trojan horse. So you had the wonderful treatment of the detective novel, but it was both a well-written detective novel and a detective novel that was about something, that was about society, that was about nationalism, that was about a whole host of other things. So you felt you were getting a kind of added value.
What can you tell us, Barry, about Henning Mankell's final book, Quicksand, what it means to be a human being?
Oddly enough, the last conversation we had in London was an interesting one. He was present for the Kenneth Branagh series, and Kenneth Branagh had just been made a knight, and he was in the room as well, being interviewed separately. And as always with Henning, whenever I met him, somehow we would talk about death. And I didn't then know that he had cancer. I didn't quite know how seriously ill he was. But he talked about his achievement, and he said that he hoped that he would be able to do something with his life before he died, other than just writing novels. And of course he did. I mean, he did social work in Africa. He did things like he joined the flotilla to break the Gaza blockade, and he had a gun trained on him by Israeli soldiers. So he was a man who put his money where his mouth was when it came to his principles. And that last book is sad, but it's also the book of a man who accepts that he is going to die.
I want to ask you about a quote of Henning Mankell's about where he said the heart of Europe lies in Lampedusa, that little Italian island where we've heard so many stories about refugees coming ashore.
Well, that was a crucial thing for him, the treatment of refugees. And in one of his books, Faceless Killers, he addresses the issue of, long before we had the current migrant crisis we've got now, he addresses Sweden's attitude to migrant crisis. But he's not holier than thou. He isn't saying, you know, I am a perfect individual, or Kurt Wallander is a perfect individual, because he has the detective acknowledge that there's something in himself that he doesn't quite like, that even though he's obviously a good and worthwhile man, he has this, like a lot of us have, a touch of racism that you have to deal with. Mm. And he didn't trust Sweden. He felt that his own country might have made all the right noises about having open arms to immigrants, but it didn't practice what it preached. We thought of it as this beautiful welfare state. Everything was working well. The people were beautiful. Immigrants, there was no problem integrating immigrants in society. The crime fiction of that country, and not just Henning Mankell, obviously Stieg Larsson, said,
right,
actually, it isn't this good. And we've got exactly the same problems as the rest of the world when it comes to dealing with the influx of, you know, people coming from outside. It's interesting to know, I mean, I haven't seen him for a while, what he would have made of the immigrant kind of trickle that is now a kind of a flood, if you like.
Writer and journalist Barry Forshaw is the author of Nordic Noir and has been telling us about the late Henning Mankell. Thanks very much, Barry.
Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A U.S. diplomat goes north of the Arctic Circle, and the experience leads him to write a novel.
We are hardwired to need light, and that was something that really stuck with me as I tried to channel what these characters would be feeling as they tried to stumble through an island that was totally dark.
His book is called Nightfall. More on that coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International and by Soundworks.org, offering perspectives on events and cultures around the globe with The World's Daily Podcast and the Studio 360 Podcast. Subscribe at Soundworks.org or iTunes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Some of the world's top scientists toil anonymously for decades, only to be recognized long after the fact. For proof of that, look no further than Tu Youyou. She was awarded a Nobel Prize today for her work decades ago to develop a new treatment for malaria, which reportedly makes her China's first Nobel laureate for medicine. Science writer Phil McKenna has met Tu Youyou and written about her for New Scientist magazine. McKenna says Tu's contribution began as part of a secret Chinese military project during the Vietnam War.
At the time, the North Vietnamese, by some accounts, were losing more people to malaria than they were to U.S. bullets.
Right.
China was an ally with the North Vietnamese, one of their very few allies, and they wanted to help. So they started this top secret a massive, massive scientific project to try to find a cure for malaria.
So China turns to the Academy of Traditional Chinese Medicine, and that's where Tu comes in. I mean, how kind of unconventional was it that the Chinese government turns to traditional medicine for this?
It was extremely unconventional, and they didn't do it right away. They initially screened some 40,000 synthetic drugs that they thought might be the cure. And this is after the U.S., they knew that the U.S. had already screened 200,000 synthetic drugs. But they decided they were desperate. They reached out to traditional Chinese medicine. They had Tu, who was in her mid-30s at the time, assemble a small lab of a few researchers to scour the ancient texts on Chinese traditional medicine and see if they could find a cure.
Now, this is kind of weird because at the time, Tu's husband was among those persecuted during the Cultural Revolution. He was banished to the countryside. The couple had a 4-year-old daughter, but Tu continued with her work anyway. I mean, she sounded really dedicated.
Yeah, her husband was an engineer, and because he was a scientist, he was banished to the countryside for being an intellectual. What's most amazing about this is that she was even doing science at the time. Science was officially banned during the Cultural Revolution, but this was seen as such an urgent need coming down from the top, from Chairman Mao himself saying, we are going to do this.
So what did Tu actually kind of deliver in terms of traditional medicine and breakthroughs in malaria?
She had studied both traditional Chinese medicine and Western medicine and could kind of act as a bridge between the two. What she eventually found, she was looking for ancient cures for fever because malaria causes a fever as well as many other things. And she screened hundreds of different possible treatments. One of them was a plant that we would call sweet wormwood. They call it Qinghao. And there's this scroll from 400 A.D., and it was called, ironically, it was called Emergency Treatments Kept Up One's Sleeve. Ironic because it had been kept up China's sleeve for hundreds and hundreds of years.
So Tu actually volunteered herself to be the first test subject. What was the actual product that she was kind of testing, and how risky was that?
It was pretty risky, but it was needed. It was needed urgently, so she volunteered.
I came down with malaria during Peace Corps in West Africa in the mid-80s. This kind of coincides with when artemisinin might have been available. What happened? Did I just miss out?
You and the rest of the Western world, we were missing out for decades. This was first available in China starting around 1973 when they were giving it to some of the North Vietnamese soldiers. They never published scientific papers on it until after the Cultural Revolution when science could begin again. But yet from 77 until 2000 or 2006, we still didn't see it widespread outside of China when the World Health Organization and some biotech companies finally picked it up.
Wow. So you met Tu a few years ago. What's she like?
Fascinating woman. Really a fire in her eyes. When I met her, I introduced myself in Chinese. I speak some Chinese. And she said in Chinese, oh, thank God this one speaks some Chinese. So, and then we went on and talked for another hour or two through lunch.
Tu Youyou was never publicly recognized in China for this breakthrough. Why not?
She's received some recognition in China, but the vast majority has been outside of the country. In China, she refers to herself as a professor of the three no's. No postgrad degree, no experience working abroad, no membership in the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Mm. So for her to win the Nobel Prize is just extraordinary recognition for an extraordinary contribution to science.
A huge day for Tu Youyou. Science writer Phil McKenna is based here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he's been telling us about her. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Every day, still, by the thousands they arrive in Europe, people fleeing war and unrest in places like Syria or Afghanistan. Others are escaping poverty in sub-Saharan Africa. European governments must process them all to decide who gets to stay and who has to leave. And one tool that's being used for that is language analysis. Amna Modine has reported on that for Quartz.
This has been going on since the late 1990s. I think Sweden led the way on this. It's why we tend to see Swedish companies being contracted to do these language analysis. And the basic premise is that you should speak the way that you say you come from, so the specific dialect from that village. Your language should kind of be as a form of evidence of your asylum story.
Right. You say Sweden's kind of at the head of this, and there are two main Swedish companies that seem to be contracted to do most of this analysis. How does it work? Are there questionnaires or in-person interviews?
So it tends to be SprackUp and Verified.
SprackUp is the name of one of these companies.
Yeah, and Verified is the second one. They both kind of have a similar process. So they usually get a native speaker to interview the asylum seeker for about 20, 25 minutes, and they just have a general chat, and it can really range from just how are you feeling, what are you up to, so there's nothing really quite specific. And then the native speaker kind of gives their general opinion of what they think, but we have to remember these native speakers don't tend to have linguistic expertise or anything. I'm a Somali and Arabic native speaker. If I wanted a part-time job and make some extra cash, I can pretty much apply for this company and do this job. And then after the initial interview, it's analysed by a linguist, and this person is actually has an academic background, has more of an understanding of the way language works.
I mean, you say these are trained linguists who kind of then come in the second instance and analyse what these people have said, but it strikes me that they would need to be more than just a trained linguist. They'd need to really know a lot, for example, about Syria and anthropology, and, you know, a person from home says a word a certain way, but maybe 100 miles down the road it's said completely differently. I mean, do they know all that stuff?
They can't possibly know all of that information. We don't have all of these linguists online to come in and know, like, different parts of Syria say different things differently. So they're going to make human error, and it's quite a big problem, I think, where, you know, if you don't have enough information, you can get someone deported.
There was one thing that I was reading about this language analysis, that the analysts go into these interviews with the refugee or migrant. They ask a number of questions while using their, quote, overall intuition, end quote, to identify particular dialectical traits. I mean, it starts to sound a little like phrenology during World War II and how the Nazis tried identifying their enemies.
Yeah, exactly. And what was interesting was someone was saying language doesn't follow man-made borders. And it makes absolutely no sense to try to analyze someone's language to decide they're from, you know, Kenya or Somalia. Linguists disagree with each other a lot about which words actually come from which area. And there have been several cases where, you know, an asylum seeker will challenge the conclusion of a report and they get a second linguist to analyze it, and the second linguist completely disagrees with the first.
Yeah, so it's really subjective, isn't it? I mean, people in the New York City area will be unable to identify somebody from Brooklyn and the Bronx. I mean, it's just sometimes that difficult. So do you see any push toward ending this practice?
No. I mean, I spoke to the Swedish Migration Board and the British Home Office, and they just said, well, what do you want us to do? The problem really is that deporting someone or rejecting someone's asylum is a very political decision to make. And I think they're trying to make it as objective as possible and using the language of science through these kind of language analysis to justify the decisions they're making. And it just kind of makes absolutely no sense for a lot of people. Now, when Europe's, you know, undergoing its biggest refugee crisis since World War II, a large majority of these people don't have any documents on them or maybe have forged documents. I do think there will be a bit of an increase in trying to see whether they're telling the truth or not about their nationality, but it's going to get even more diluted and even less regulated.
I'm curious, do people who have been rejected after one of these language accent interviews, do they have a chance to appeal the decision?
Well, it depends where you come from. In the UK, if you come from a country the UK has deemed safe, let's say Kenya, you can challenge this report, but you have to do it back in the country that they say you're from. So you're going to have to challenge that asylum claim back in Kenya.
Amna Mohiuddin, who's been reporting on the process of language analysis for refugees for courts, thanks very much for telling us about this.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Language analysts would have a tough time making out anything very comprehensible in the mix of languages spoken in Lebanon. If I asked you what language they speak there, you might say Arabic. You're a third of the way there. Many people, though, in Lebanon are not just bilingual. They are trilingual, fluent in Arabic, French, and English. And it's not uncommon, says reporter Dalia Mortada, to be walking around the markets of Beirut and hear all three in one sentence.
This high-end organic farmers market in downtown Beirut is buzzing with activity. Buyers and sellers speak a mishmash of languages, usually Arabic and English or French. Just trying to pay for juice, I have to switch back and forth from English to Arabic.
It was how much in
32 in 13 75 فبدك مني 43
ايوه
ماما عقلوفه اعطيتينا الوفه فقد بدل 40 بدك تضلك مني ولا اقل
even the currency is close to change.
Pia Buchhalter is at the market with me. She's a creative writer based in Beirut, and she met with me at the market to talk about living in this mishmash of languages.
So when I'm interacting with people, like buying things, I'm trying to bargain or whatever it is, I think I'm just used to it when I'm here in Lebanon in Arabic. I rarely switch. I do often try and figure out what the green leafy thing in question is. Like, oh, is this the same as that in English? And then the word in French comes up and I'm like, no, I don't know in French. Like, please stop making this difficult.
Multilingualism, the way Pia knows it, is not uncommon in Beirut. Many people hear code switch in varying degrees, says linguist Lubna Dimachki.
Code switching, you know what it means. It's like when you combine two languages in one sentence or in the whole interaction. You can say one sentence and another one. So when people do this, there are... Merci.
Catch that, merci. Dimachki seamlessly uses the French word to say thanks to our waiter. Dimachki is considered francophone, meaning her dominant second language is French. But that's not the only reason she used the French merci. In Lebanon, hellos, thank yous, and how are yous are often said in French. Arabic is the core language, but kids are taught in English or French at school. French and English language schools have been around since the 1800s, when Catholic and Anglican missionaries arrived in the region. Then, after World War I, Lebanon was ruled by the French until the 1940s. But another linguist, Lina Shouedi, says the regular mixing of the three languages in everyday life actually didn't happen until much later.
My father, who was educated and he went to school and he knew both French and English, absolutely hated the code switching.
Shouedi's dad's generation just communicated in Arabic all the time. Shouedi, who went to school in the 80s, code switched.
My father would say, just when you start your sentence with a language, just stick to it. Don't switch to another language.
Back at the market, Pia agrees with Shouedi's dad. She's not crazy about the idea that people should be expected to know English or French.
What if you don't know the other two extra languages that come in a country? It's in one way or another, it's like linguistic racism.
Arabic is the core language of Lebanon, she explains. English, and even more so French, were imposed through colonialism and occupation, and they're remnants of that complicated history. But linguist Dimachki sees all this code-switching in a different light. The way people code-switch in Beirut is unique. It's not necessarily determined by age or ethnicity, she says. And it's not relegated to home or school or the juice stand at the market. Multilingualism is everywhere. That's what makes Beirut different from cities like Barcelona, Jerusalem, or L.A. Like, a person in L.A. might speak Spanish at home and English at work. But in Beirut?
They are not foreigners. They are all Lebanese talking with Lebanese, so why all this code switching? You'll never see two French speaking to each other in German or in Spanish or in Chinese.
And yet, that's exactly what Beirutis do. Street signs are in Arabic and French. Government websites often include English. Menus in lots of restaurants or cafes are in all three languages, and you'll hear people switching between them. Lebanese joke that this mishmash of languages is the Lebanese mother tongue.
So when you have a Lebanese mother tongue, that means it's part of your identity in a way. Oh, this is what you are claiming to be part of your identity.
There's even a Lebanese mother tongue t-shirt. Hi, kifak, sava, it says. Greetings in English, Arabic, and French. My friend Pia calls it the bastard sentence that sums it all up. For the world, I'm Dalia Mortada in Beirut.
Here's a taste now of a story we've got coming up right after the break. Peter Kujawinski had a long career as a U.S. Foreign Service officer.
In my 18-year career as a diplomat, I was in places like Haiti and Israel and lots of places in between. But I tell people the most exotic place that I ever was in was Canada.
Not just anywhere in Canada. He spent a lot of time north of the Arctic Circle, and that meant getting used to a month and a half of near total darkness in the winter. Now Kujawinski has turned that experience into a novel called Nightfall. Picture walking in the dark and among polar bears. That's coming up in a minute or so. Make sure you grab a flashlight. You're tuned to The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Imagine this. You live on an island with 14 years of sunlight followed by 14 years of night. And when the darkness comes, you need to flee or else. Now imagine you accidentally get left behind. That is the premise for the new young adult novel, Nightfall. And it probably would not be material for this show, The World, were it not for the fact that the co-author of Nightfall is a former U.S. diplomat, Peter Kujawinski.
I was the Consul General for Alberta, Saskatchewan, and the Northwest Territories. And the Northwest Territories is this crazy area about three times the size of Texas, with a population of not more than about 40,000. And it really is the Wild North. And I went up to a place called Tuktoyaktuk, which is a tiny little hamlet of a couple hundred people on the shores of the Beaufort Sea, the Arctic Ocean. And there, they have about 2 months, just over 2 months of nonstop daylight during the summertime, and about a month and a half of nonstop winter, nonstop dark. And while I was writing Nightfall, I realized the absence of light was much more important than I had initially thought.
And what did those prolonged periods of darkness do to your own head?
It was a strange feeling. When I spoke with people who were there, especially this one person who was a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer, he said that he didn't realize how much he needed light until he had been there about a month and he was going to go down south. And he remembers getting onto the plane very, very vividly, and it was total dark. It had been dark for about a month. And the plane rises up into the air and goes on for about half hour. And then in the distance, he sees the first hint of light. Mm. And it's on the horizon. You can't even see the sun yet. And he remembers starting to tear up.
Wow.
And he looks at me and he says, "You know, Peter, I never realized how much I really needed to see the light." And that phrase stuck with me so much when I was writing Nightfall, because we live in a world where light is all around us, especially in cities. But when you're plunged into absolute darkness, it does something to you because it's part of who we are. We are hardwired to need light. And that was something that really stuck with me as I tried to channel what these characters would be feeling as they tried to stumble through an island that was totally dark.
Was it ever physically scary, or did it just work you over psychologically?
There was a moment where I was scared, and it wasn't just a little nervous. I was absolutely scared, and it was probably my own fault, because what I did is I went out onto the ice, and from Tuktoyaktuk, the only way to access any other town are through ice roads built on the Arctic Ocean. And it's this smooth as glass ice, and there's nothing on there because it's just a couple hundred people and it's just infrequently used. And I walked out on there, and this is during a time where it's an average high of minus 14 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm. And you walk out, and I heard cracking, and I heard something in the distance. And I don't know what it was, but my mind immediately recognized it as something to be worried about. And so I ran back, and I was speaking to some folks there, and they said, "You really shouldn't have been doing that, because you know it's during the night that the polar bears are more frequent."
And you said, thanks for telling me now.
Exactly. I remember calling up my co-author, Jake, about not only this experience, but also the weird experience of being there. And he said, "Yeah, I'm sorry that happened to you, but you know what? This is incredibly good material for the book." And he was absolutely right.
So you and co-author Jake Halpern tell this story in Nightfall. Night is a time of unknown and uncertainty. Was your aim, your and Jake's aim, to have young adults experience this darkness by really just being thrown right into this haunting world?
Absolutely. You know, darkness and the night are something that we worry about as human beings, not because we have to be taught it. It's because it's intrinsic to who we are. Thousands of years ago, if you walked around blissfully at night, something would happen. Something not very good would happen. And we don't need to be taught that. And I think what Jake and I wanted to do most of all is to have young adults and adults who read the book remember again or remember perhaps for the first time, but recall something deep within them, and that is that fear of the dark is just part of who we are. It's part of being human beings.
You know, we tend to think of diplomatic hardship posts as either being in a war zone or being someplace that doesn't have clean water. It sounds like you could make an argument for being posted in Canada or above the Arctic Circle as a hardship post.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that. In my 18-year career as a diplomat, I was in places like Haiti and Israel and lots of places in between. But I tell people the most exotic place that I ever was in was Canada. And of course, it's kind of done for a laugh, but it's true. I mean, you go up to the Arctic Circle, above the Arctic Circle, to places like Tuktoyaktuk and Sachs Harbor and Inuvik. And these are places that are so remote, so desolate, that they don't have trees. The tallest tree in a place like Tuktoyaktuk is actually not a tree. It's a tiny little bush about ankle high, and it produces cloud berries, this weird kind of orange tundra raspberry that only flourishes in July and August. And it's just one of these wild places that's very much on the very margins of where human beings can live.
You know, when you were describing those dark nights up around the Arctic Circle, if it had been me, I think I would have turned to some, I don't know, some Fats Waller or some Louis Armstrong to just ease the depression. Were you listening to any kind of particular music to just kind of ease yourself out of that, frankly, scary situation?
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you should mention that, but Louis Armstrong was on my playlist.
Are you serious?
And there's something about that voice that was deeply comforting to me. There's something about how savagely cold the place is and how beautiful it is that something warm and comforting like Louis Armstrong's voice was really needed at that particular moment.
Peter Kujawinski is the co-author of the new young adult novel Nightfall, along with Jake Halpern. Peter, thanks so much for the interview. Good to speak with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much, Marco.
No one to talk with, all by myself. No one to walk with, I'm happy on the shelf, babe. Ain't misbehaving, saving my love. Oh, baby, love you, really, baby, love you. I know it's saying, one I love, through it flooding. You that I'm thinking of, ain't misbehaving, saving my love. Oh, baby, my love for you.
Louis Armstrong and his orchestra there with Ain't Misbehavin', a whole lot of musical light to counter the Arctic darkness. That's all for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
Daddy, 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 I don't stay out late, don't care to go, I'm home about it.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. The PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Rose Family Fund. By the United States Japan Foundation, the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation working to build a world where nuclear weapons will never be used again. By the PRI Ambassador Council, including Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brandon Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Ann Cerisi. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.